We'll proceed to the fourth case, the United States versus Rogers.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mike Frelick and I represent defendant appellant Robert Rogers. Mr. Rogers very briefly was charged with possession of child pornography. He pleaded guilty to that offense by way of a written plea agreement. After a sentencing hearing was held, he was sentenced to 78 months in incarceration. That sentence is calculated under the United States sentencing guidelines. Certain enhancements were used. That's what we're dealing with essentially today is a number of enhancements. Relevant to our discussion today, the number of images enhancements is part of our argument, whether the materials portrayed sadistic or masochistic materials, and whether the materials portrayed a prepubescent minor or a minor under the age of 12. In our brief, we presented three arguments. Again, briefly, the first argument was that the number of images and sadistic masochistic materials enhancements were unconstitutional as they impermissibly threaten the institutional integrity of the judiciary. The second was that the district court erred in applying an enhancement for sadistic masochistic images because all child pornography is, under the current definition of sadistic masochistic, all child pornography is considered to be or can be considered to be sadistic masochistic, and then thus it counts as double counting because the conduct is already taken account of in the base offense level.
But hasn't this court essentially rejected that position? It's not that anybody thinks that any child pornography isn't very damaging, but the sadistic or masochistic enhancement is calling for worse, you know, for more. And in a fairly recent case, you know, we've said that it's a sufficient additional or separate aspect. That's the Bell decision. But I mean, just as a matter of common sense, you could imagine a pornographic picture that didn't indicate pain, and you could imagine one that did indicate pain. And we're able to draw those lines, aren't we?
I don't dispute that, Your Honors. However, the definitions don't center around pain. They don't center around...
Giving that as an example, sadistic things might
right.
be...
The definitions that were given by or that were cited with approval essentially in United States v. I think Turchin is how it's pronounced, they're so broad and they're so numerous that it doesn't take a broad sort of leap to come to the conclusion that all child pornography is abusive to the victim and then therefore it's a depiction of abuse.
But as applied to this particular case, even if there were a case somewhere near the boundary where you might say, gee, you know, have we actually crossed over from just the, if you will, the ordinary harm that child pornography inflicts to something that's enough worse that a more severe sentence should be called for? Frankly, you know, this case doesn't seem very near the margins to me.
And I don't think, if I understand your argument correctly, Judge,
I mean, kind of as applied, we're way up here. You know, maybe the boundary is somewhere down here, and so there may come a case someday where we have to decide was it double counting. But I don't see that your case is one, your client's case.
Judge, I think the I'm not sure I understand the point that you're making correctly because it would seem to me that it wouldn't matter where it landed on the spectrum of sadistic masochistic because the base offense level would take into account even the minorest, even the closest, the borderline.
And that's what I'm contesting. It seems to me the base offense level assumes that the materials meet the basic definition of child pornography, which is, you know, in the statute. And then the enhancement is for things that are that go far beyond that, sadistic or masochistic behavior. The basic definition, just is talking about, you know, erotic and lascivious and all the rest of that, depicting sexual intercourse or on and on. There's nothing necessarily sadistic or masochistic about those.
the sexually explicit conduct that is a part of the definition of child pornography. Child pornography is defined as, loosely defined as, a visual depiction of a minor engaged in sexually explicit conduct.
Right.
Sexually explicit conduct is
and
then defined, as,
yeah.
And it includes, among other things, sadistic masochistic.
But
so
it
right,
doesn't have to be that. Those are separated by ors.
Correct, correct. But again, the argument that the defendant is making essentially is that Turchin has defined it so broadly that it essentially becomes the exception that swallows the rule. That
if I understand your argument correctly, then the Sentencing Commission cannot properly differentiate between an erotic picture of a nude 17-year-old girl or boy and a video of a 2 or 3 year old toddler crying in pain as an adult violates her. Is that right? Both of those fall within the legal definition of child pornography.
Potentially. A mere picture of even an erotic picture.
Assume that that can qualify as child pornography.
Are you saying
there's no difference that the Sentencing Commission is double counting by treating those the same?
Under the very broad definitions that are spelled out in Turchin, yes. I realize that it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If I think we've addressed that argument. If Your Honor have any other questions, I'd move on.
I understood you to want to be just preserving that argument in light of the Myers case.
Correct, Judge.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And essentially, I realize that Myers does address this fairly on point. I point out that it's a precursor guideline, and I'm just asking the Court to look at it from the perspective of the definitions in Turchin and maybe reassess it. The first argument that was made in the brief, Judge, was that Congress's direct legislation amending certain enhancements were impermissibly threatens the institutional integrity of the judiciary and therefore violates the separation of powers as laid out in Mistretta.
But Mistretta is the exact opposite. Mistretta worries about whether legislative people and whether putting judges on this commission is interfering with legislation. Congress passes statutory minima, statutory maxima. Congress sometimes specifies the whole statute. That's clearly within the legislative authority.
The concern that I think that the defendant's argument is making essentially is that, yes, the Sentencing Commission was set up as an independent agency that would use, first it was to address sentencing disparities. This is very important. It was to address the sentencing disparities and that similarly situated defendants would be treated similarly. To do that, the Sentencing Commission was to comb through reams and reams of data and use judicial expertise and experience to come up with a rationalized system that would treat similarly situated defendants similarly.
But getting back to Mistretta, the argument was that the Congress had given the judges too much legislative authority, not the legislators too much judicial authority. Mistretta upholds the commission anyway, so we have any authority to do something about it. But
the concern, I guess, Judge, is it's a hook upon it is a small hook upon which to hang the hat, but it doesn't change the fact that the concern here is the appearance of propriety and the reputation of the judiciary. Essentially, when we look at the United States sentencing guidelines, we look at them and say, those are promulgated by an independent agency with reams and reams of data. It's based on science. It's based on experience. To sort of paraphrase Judge Posner, it's not based on the idiosyncratic penological views of Congress, essentially. It's based on data. When Congress set this up, it set it up as a rationalized system. And then it steps in and it sort of, to coin a phrase, de-rationalizes the system by monkeying with specific guidelines so that similarly situated defendants are no longer treated similarly.
Happens too under Booker, of course, to the extent we give discretion back to the district court judges. And, you know, there is a strong argument to be made in penological theory that assessing the degree of punishment that's appropriate for particular crimes is very much a legislative decision. you know, it's not something that's obvious.
And I again, I don't dispute that Congress could do what it attempted to do here if it had rid itself of the Sentencing Commission. If it didn't say that these guidelines are promulgated by the Sentencing Commission, by the reasonable standards
so
and the rationalized
kind of
standards.
So is this kind of consumer fraud theory?
It's based on the concept that Congress has stepped in and cloaked itself, to use the language of Mistretta, it cloaked its political action in the disinterestedness and in the neutral colors of the judiciary.
For a while there, I mean, the same legislation that imposed these requirements also said you cannot have more than three judges on the Sentencing Commission. So there were some issues about the dignity of the judiciary raised at that time. You're not trying to suggest, are you, that statutory mandatory minimums intrude upon the dignity of the judiciary or the separate roles of the branches?
No, I don't think that based on the fact that the commission was set up with those in mind. Mm-hmm. It's essentially, it comes down to there's a process here, and there's a reputation to that process, and that's essentially the dignity of the court that we're talking about. And Congress steps in and sort of sneakily almost starts amending guidelines directly. And, I mean, Rehnquist didn't like this, and numerous judges didn't like it. They said, especially that this will do serious damage to the structure of the sentencing guidelines. And that's essentially the argument, that it did do serious damage, and it defeats and frustrates the purpose of the sentencing guidelines. And that is where they've taken...
They acted unconstitutionally?
The argument is, yes, that they have, that they're taking their political act and they're cloaking it in judicial action. And they're on the cover of the guidelines. It says promulgated by the United States Sentencing Guidelines Commission, or Sentencing Commission, and it's not.
They're just advisory anyway. I mean, I just have trouble. I mean, it may be bad policy. You know, the Rules Committee doesn't like it either when Congress jumps in with a federal rule, but nobody says they can't do it. Of course they can do it. These are more refined arguments. Is this a good idea or not? It's really not a constitutional question.
But didn't Congress write some rules of evidence in the last few years? Was that unconstitutional?
No, Judge, but again, I think the idea here is that there is an appearance that the Sentencing Commission is acting independently when they're not, and that's the concern, that it's affecting the reputation of the judiciary. And I see my time is nearly up.
You're at the rebuttal point. So if you want to borrow those 3 minutes, you can. Otherwise, you can save them.
I'll save them, Judge.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mallory.
May it please the Court. My name is Monica Mallory, and I represent the United States. I'm going to skip, if I may, to the question about whether this enhancement was double counting. The enhancement for possession of images depicting sadistic and masochistic or violent conduct taken with children is not double counting. First of all, defendant did not argue that point in district court, and it's our position that he forfeited it. But even if he had not forfeited it, because the base offense level, as I believe you all have pointed out, encompasses the total categories, all of them, of what might be child pornography. And this enhancement encompasses a subset of that category and decides that it should be punished more stringently, that double counting has not occurred. I do agree that all of these images are abusive to children. I think we can all agree on that. But to say that we should apply the enhancement for sadistic, masochistic, or violent conduct on all child pornography images would, in effect, punish every type of image too stringently. We do need the subset. That will allow us to have gradations of punishment based on the type of image possessed by the accused. With respect to defendant's argument that, which I don't believe you covered, which I think I should cover, is whether or not the district court has sufficient evidence to apply these enhancements to the defendant and sentence him accordingly. I want to point out that defendant entered a plea agreement, and in that plea agreement he admitted to the possession to the use of the computer. He specifically, in that plea agreement, agreed that certain guideline sections applied to his conduct, did not dispute those guideline sections in his plea agreement. Those included the fact that the images involved prepubescent minors, involved the portrayal of depictions of violence, that it involved the use of a computer, and that they numbered over 600. Then there was the pre-sentence report, which defined and described his offense conduct. And at that point, he had an opportunity to object to that and did not. Then, during the sentencing proceeding, he was asked specifically by the judge, do you have any objection to the factual information contained in the PSR about your offense conduct? And at that point, he did not object to the factual information. And so the only thing left were his objections raised to the application of the guidelines, the legal question about their application, not the factual question.
So this is the section, I think you're talking about the section of his brief where he's complaining that the writer of the PSR received information that would have been from you, I guess.
Yes, it would have been.
And we have this paragraph, which we will not read, on page 9 about what sort of content there was in some of these videos.
Yes.
And I guess his complaint is that there wasn't a sufficient foundation for that representation on your part.
Right. For the judge to take that representation. Right. And absent an objection from the defendant, particularly in this case where there's been a plea and an agreement in the plea that these guidelines apply, and we believe we're past that point, absent an objection that they don't apply factually speaking, the government is not put to its test of putting on evidence, which they would have done had they known.
Yeah, I take it your position is had an objection been raised, you were prepared to put whatever evidence was necessary on to show that these were of that sort.
Yes, and there would be a record then for you to look at. What the record, I think, does show you is the absence of that evidence and I think it's clear that there was no objection. That shows you that the defendant, through his counsel, made some sort of strategical decision at sentencing, looking at the evidence which he knew existed, that he was not going to attack the factual application of the guideline. He was going to launch his attack down that road of a constitutional attack that it doesn't apply to him.
At the sentencing hearing, I gather it was fairly well attended.
It was.
The defendant had a lot of friends and family there.
A lot of support, 30 or 40 people.
Would have been pretty painful to go through the presentation of that evidence, I
believe.
I suspect.
It would. Yes, I would. I believe it would have been something he would not have wanted to do or enjoyed, and would have conflicted with his approach just personally to sentencing about, you know, accepting responsibility and recognizing the damage to the children from these images. So, you know, I believe it was a strategical decision, and now we're trying to reverse our position, essentially, and attack everything about the evidence, and the government just has not had an opportunity to establish the burden it has, which is the preponderance, and had it had the opportunity, it certainly would have done so. Absent any other questions, I have nothing more to say. Thank you. We ask that you affirm the court's decision on sentencing.
Thank you, Ms. Mallory.
The argument of counsel is that the defendant agreed that these enhancements applied through the plea agreement. And as I stated in my reply brief, that studiously ignores language that says the guidelines contained in the plea, quote, are preliminary in nature and are non-binding predictions upon which neither party is entitled to rely. The court ultimately determines the facts and law relevant to sentencing. So there is no agreement. As far as could there have been something in the plea agreement that would have laid out all of this relevant conduct? Yes, there could have been. And then we wouldn't be standing here having this argument.
But why isn't, once the PSR sets forth the alleged details of this material, the burden is on the defendant to raise, you know, bring to the court's attention any objections that the defendant has. If the defendant doesn't object to the PSR, then, as Ms. Malloy is saying, the government doesn't know you know, isn't alerted to go forward with whatever supporting evidence it may have. Maybe it hasn't, maybe it doesn't, but, you know, that the process actually doesn't get going, and there's no objection here.
The PSR states, and I'm going to paraphrase it here, the government uses its plea agreement and the relevant conduct contained in the plea agreement for its official version of the events. The defendant agrees with the facts as contained in the plea agreement. So right there, the state and the government and the court should be on notice that that's what he agrees with. The rest of this could be construed and should be construed as argument.
I don't think so. I mean, the system really would fall apart if we didn't put a responsibility on either side, frankly, to raise to the court's attention any objection to anything. And that's a routine part of sentencing hearings. Sometimes the government says, we object to the decision that such enhancement doesn't apply. And sometimes the defendant says, you know, that's not a correct description of relevant conduct or whatever. People put on the table. And then the court is alerted to the fact that further proceedings are necessary at sentencing. I just don't see where that happened
here. Again, I do. It didn't happen here. But again, the reason I don't think it needs to happen here is because the cases that are cited by the government in support of the idea that a fact not objected to is a fact admitted do not seem to describe the situation that we have here.
Are you suggesting the judge should have recognized that there was double counting in the agreed?
This has to do with the whether or not the government proved sadistic masochistic.
No, I appreciate it, but I want to speak to you about the double counting.
And I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
You didn't object to the double counting.
No.
Below. Should the judge? So we were looking at this as plain error, I assume.
Correct, Judge.
So how would a judge be alerted to the double counting issue?
It's a good argument on the government's part. I will concede that.
Well, your argument is that it's just a question of law,
right?
And the judge should have recognized that.
Correct.
Now, different people may disagree with you about that, but that's...
That's correct, Judge. I see my time is over. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. Our thanks to all counsel.